Welcome to the Portion Podcast, a weekly discussion of the Torah portion of the week. I am your co-host, Aaron Roller, here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Hello, everyone.
We are recording this a little bit before Purim, and we'll be posting it probably maybe on Purim, probably the day before. I don't know. What are your Purim plans?
My Purim plans are to be Besimcha. That's my Purim plan. Which is a very funny sort of simcha. I have to say, and we've spoken about this a little bit before, I think mostly off air, but that my, I don't know, this is maybe going to be one of those tell-all moments. My relationship with Purim is a little strained, I think.
I was really just making chit-chat. But no, tell us what
well, this is sort of awkward. Can I extricate myself from this?
No,
I,
now,
I'm curious.
Why is your relationship with Purim strange?
I just think it's different. It's like a very different,
this is rabbinic confessions over
yeah,
here.
Yeah. It's a very different experience being married with kids and the whole, everything that means on Purim. I just find very not jarring, just different. I don't know. I think that's part of it. I think also that
different than what? When you were a child?
Than when I was single, like when I was in yeshiva. I think it's part of it. And also in my elderly state, we've never really discussed this on air, and I guess you can't see us, so there's no way to know. But I'm 87, and I guess in my elderly state, it's that I like things kind of slower, like being able to, you know, ease into things a little bit more and having a little bit more time. And like Pesach does it for me, you know, Sukkot does it for me. That the idea of having, I guess, it what used to be almost interminable about the holidays to some degree, now it's just like I love it. I just love having a full week to sort of ease into something. And Purim is almost so frantic that I guess as an old man as I am. Apologies if it's hard to hear me, it's because my very long and sagacious beard is getting stuck in the microphone, but I find it like so much to try to do and to try to accomplish and to try to think about and to try to, meditate over all in the span of just 24 hours. I just find it very difficult.
So it's interesting you say that because I find that when you talk about interminable, like there's a lot going on the night. You have the Megillah reading and, you know, maybe there's some kind of party or whatever, or you know, you're baking hamantaschen or getting your mishloach manot ready, and then now the next day you gotta go and hear the Megillah again in the morning, maybe deliver some mishloach manot, but that doesn't take all day, or you're home and people are delivering them to you, and then there's this big lull between that time and your seuda, which is, you know, not going to be until the afternoon, and I find it always sort of like a weird pace to the day.
Maybe we could swap places. Maybe you want to come over here. Maybe you want to come over to our house.
I usually do.
Uh-huh. So that's yeah, there is no lull. I find Purim to be lulless. There's no lull because you got shalach manos going on, people coming to the house, and you're bringing stuff to other people. I'm also involved in the whole community's matanos le'avyonim, the delivering of you know, of gifts to those in need. So that also takes up some time. But I just find that there is just so much going on, and keeping track of all the everybody's schedules and, you know, what the kids want to be doing and where they're going and baskets flying this way and that way. The next thing you know, the seuda rolls around and it's just it's a lot.
Well, maybe I'm misremembering. I'll report back after the holiday and tell you.
Please. And hey, I'm really sorry for bearing my soul. I thought you were genuinely, legitimately interested. I did not realize that this was one of those empty and insincere, I guess, sorts of questions.
What I was really doing was like kind of pitching you a softball to promote the Young Israel's Purim Suda, the big meal you guys are hosting at the is that at the JCC?
At the Cast JCC, yeah.
Yes.
Same
location as our live show.
Right, in that same enormous room. I think the largest room at this point. It's one of the few structures that can actually be seen with the naked eye from outer space. That room that we had the live show in.
It was really something to behold.
Yeah. And just a quick word to our listener in Spain. We understand, you know, that the you know, the airfare is probably not cheap to fly in for the youngest of Cherry Hill Perm Suda. So we'll comp your, you know, your ticket to the Suda in order to, you know, give you the ability to fly in for that.
You watch out. You watch out. You're going to get a, you're going to get a, an email or something. Great.
Hey, I'm Spain. We want you. We want you at the youngest of Cherry Hill Perm Suda, Spain.
Yeah, and we've also got, I've noticed we've started to have listeners. The podcast host, we can't see your address. We don't know what you like to buy. We're not Facebook, but our hosting platform does allow us to see something of the geographic distribution of our listenership. And in the last couple of weeks, we've had two listens every week from Vermont.
So one is Bernie Sanders.
That's what I'm saying.
And I guess his wife. I guess. They're probably listening on different devices. It's, but they're probably not doing it like, you know, like, hey, let's get together and, you know, have a glass of wine and listen to, you know, the portion. They're probably doing it individually, you know, separately on their own devices.
I think they do it at the same time, but on different devices.
Oh, but
devices,
also on different. Oh, that also
could, with headphones in.
That's possible. Oh, I hope not. That's so sad for the Sanderses.
I don't even, that's a vision. That's a vision. All right. So let's talk about Parshat Tzav. We are still in, so Tzav, this is, you want to do a quick summary of what this Torah portion is about?
Yeah. I mean, effectively it's more laws regarding some of the specific, karbanot, some of the specific sacrifices that are going to be offered in the Mishkan. And then deals with at random some other little blips on the radar screen here about the koshering of different types of utensils that might be used, some issues of general purity and impurity with respect to the karbanos, the sacrifices actually coming into contact, which are supposed to be pure, coming into contact with different things and perhaps rendering other people pure, impure. And then the sort of the back half, or more than the back half, a large chunk of the parsha is really dedicated to the, I guess, the induction ceremony of the Kohanim, in which Moshe is sort of bringing his brother Aaron, and then also Aaron's sons, into the position, into the role of serving as Kohanim in the Mishkan.
So something I wanted to talk about last week, but we got very far afield on the question about giving meat to God and other topics, was the different types of sacrifices that there are, and they're kind of enumerated in a slightly different format in this week, so we can still, it's evergreen. You've got your chatat, which is, I guess, you start with ola. You've got your olas, and that was
starts with ola at the beginning of this parsha,
and the ola has a, there's the tamid also, which is a form of ola, right? That is the sacrifice that's given just every day, like basically like clockwork,
as a communal, well, twice every day, every communal offering,
once in the morning and once in the afternoon.
That's right.
And this week's parsha actually starts to talk about the ashes that are burning all through the night. That there is this the,
well, that there are portions of the karbanos that are going to be, right, that are going to be left on the mizbeach and then burning all night.
Right. So and it's sort of a ceremony each day to rake the coals and clean it off and sort of start a new day.
Right. And that was considered that was like a sought after kind of opportunity.
And there's something beautiful about the image of like it's okay. So there's, and we talked about this in past weeks, the idea that of the sacrifices corresponding to the three daily prayers, and then there's debate within amongst different sources of Jewish law as to whether or not Ma'ariv or Arvit, the evening prayer, whether it is at the same level of obligation as the first, as the morning and the afternoon, because the morning there's this sacrifice and the afternoon there's a sacrifice, but there is no tamid,
right, no independent at night. Right, exactly. There's no self standing sacrifice that would be burnt during the night. It was more of the remnants or the leftovers from that which was burned during the day.
So something is burning, but it's just like I like the idea of like the you know, the nighttime is the time when things are not as maybe not as strong, maybe not as definitive. Maybe it's like the you know, I don't know, there's something very evocative about the embers, about the, you know, there's darkness and the your efforts are a little bit you know, not quite as full throated, but there's still sort of something burning, and then the day starts fresh again.
Well, there's the verse that we recite really a number of times over the course of, certainly over the course of Shabbos, and it's part of the Kabbalah Shabbos prayer that we say, Lahagid baboker chazdecha v'munasecha b'leilos, and speaking about the way, the manner in which we relate to Hashem, it's sort of different during the day and at night. Lahagid baboker chazdecha, that we speak of your chesed, your kindness, in the morning, during the day, meaning when metaphorically, when things are bright, things are clear, there are those moments, whether it's in Jewish history or the course of our lives, that things are bright, things are clear, we sense Hashem's presence very acutely, and we recognize his chesed, that he's kind to us, that he provides us with blessing, and we're the beneficiaries of it. And then when it comes to the nighttime, it's a little different. We speak about his emunah, or the emunah that we have in him, the faith that we maintain in Hashem. And perhaps that image is being, or perhaps that idea is being invoked with this image, the idea that it's not its own sacrifice, it's sort of whatever came about during the day that I sort of have to hold on to as those burning embers to sort of carry me through the night, to provide a little bit of light even when things become a little bit dark and a little bit confusing. And then the next morning rolls around and there's this opportunity to sort of do a sweep and provide a fresh new start to a brand new day.
It's referred to as an Eish Tamid, as an eternal flame.
Eish Tamid Tukar Al Mizbeach Lo Tichbe. Yeah, that has to be constantly present and it can never be extinguished.
So is that the source for the Ner Tamid that's in in Shuls?
The Ner Tamid probably is the flame of the menorah that never went out. Probably, but there are multiple ever burning fires of the Mishkan. And you know, there's something very, you know, it's like we don't even have this anymore. But I always thought of this as such a powerful sort of image. You know, the idea of like a pilot light. Right, that it never quite completely goes out. We don't have pilot lights anymore, but at least I don't know. If there's anybody out there who sells a pilot light, make sure it's burning. But the idea, you know, this was sort of the advice when you know you're on hiatus from yeshiva, and you're at a point where you know things are going to sort of be slowed down, and you're not going to be learning with the same sort of vigor that you do when you're in yeshiva. You're not really going to be keeping up with your studying to the same degree. But that it's important to sort of keep the pilot light going. I mean, you want to be able to have something that you can then use to reignite the greater fire from when you go back. And I think it's so true of so many different points in our lives. There are times that we, you know, listen, we're all very busy, and the way that life just exists and how it manifests itself in today's day and age is that we're probably busier than ever before with all of the modern novel advancements and time savers. We find ourselves busier than we ever have been, but nevertheless, sometimes they're busier than others. And there's that idea of like, you know, like the Eish Tamid, you gotta somehow or another find a way to keep the fires burning, whether it's, you know, I'm not going to have the opportunity for as much time for prayer or for study or for you know chesed or for community work. You know, I might need to rely upon, let's say, just listening to a podcast. Whatever it is, you know, there's got to be that absolute that I'm not going to let a day go by that I'm not engaged, that I'm not connected on whatever those different, you know, wavelengths are. You got to constantly keep it burning so that there's always something to sort of reignite from when the opportunity presents itself.
Do you know the song, There Is a Light that Never Goes Out?
I don't know that song.
By the Smiths?
I knew the Smiths. They were
your neighbors.
They were neighbors of ours in Toledo. Yeah. Al and Rhonda.
Yeah. No. It's a song.
I didn't know they weren't very musical. That's very surprising to me.
Some people said that about the 80s British rock band. But no, anyway, I don't know. It doesn't have too much to do with it. Just that it's a song about young romance and just being caught up in love and sort of there's nothing about really lights going out at all, except that in the sort of in the being swept up in the excitement, the singer Morrissey says there starts saying there's a light that never goes out over and over again, and I guess that's that if that the only real association is just, you know, being caught up in passion, being associated with a light that never goes out, and that's which is interesting, because you would think of getting caught up in something very passionate as being a like a bonfire, and yet the idea of you know, like you said, a pilot light or something that might weaken and yet never goes out is I think it's something that we could take with you, and I think that,
yeah, I think it's the reality of so many things. It is the reality of relationships, whether it's a
are you getting a fax?
I'm getting I'm getting a very important fax. Somebody sent me a very important fax in 1991, and it's just getting here now. Hold on a second, let me take a look.
What, are you printing something?
Ah, yeah. Okay, good. Yeah, no, I was waiting for this. Yeah, so. Yeah, no, so Ross Perot is going to run.
Is that Sarah? Did Sarah
and he
something?
Wanted my rabbinic approbation just to... And yeah, I'm all for it. I think he's a great candidate.
Good. You should send him a fax back.
I will.
You hear that, Bernie? Perot has got our endorsement. I don't think any of that's making on the show.
No, I hope not. I sure hope not. But anyway, I think it's a very important... reality to remember, also when it comes to relationships, whether they're romantic relationships or, you know, husband and wife or whatever the case may be, that there are going to be opportunities to, I guess, really engage and really celebrate. You know, there are going to be those moments where you know, you get to have, you know, a nice dinner out or something special that, you know, that you were really looking forward to, and an opportunity to really spend some really great, fun, exciting, celebratory quality time together, a celebration of an anniversary, a vacation together, whatever it is. But for the most part, it just doesn't work that way. For the most part, life is just overcome and overcrowded by so many other tasks and so many other errands that it's impossible to, you know, life is not a vacation. And I think if we are always looking for that great bonfire, for that time of great intensity and great passion, if that's all that it is, then that's going to be ever elusive. And we have to be able to find the ways that even over the course of a busy, crowded schedule to make the time that we need to make sure that the flames never die, and that there are those moments of conversation and mini celebration, even in the context of a lot of busyness.
So, all right. So that's the Ola, which literally means to go up. So that's an offering that is burned completely. That's all for God. But there are other, and the carbon tamid, and tamid means constant. So the tamid was an ola. They were olas that were offered twice a day on this right. constant basis. But then there are others which are eaten between, you know, God, so to speak, and people.
Right. Whether those people are the kohanim, that would be the case for, let's say, a chatas or for an asham, different kinds of sin offerings.
What's the difference between a chatat and an asham?
Offered for different prohibitions violated in different circumstances, but they are effectively going to be, you know, split, if you will, between God and the kohanim. So they're eaten by people, but they are considered to be of a higher, you know, grade of sanctity, of purity. They have to be specifically eaten within the, I don't know, we'll call it the temple, you know, compound, by the Kohanim. And then you have other karbanos. You have like a shlamim that is a split, you know, where the actual owner, the bringer of the karban, actually gets a portion as well. And it's still considered holy and sanctified, but you know, then it gets further divided.
But the difference being that these ones which are for guilt, the chatat, which refers to the word chet and sin, and asham, which refers to the word, asham literally means guilt, those are obligatory offerings. If you do something wrong and right. you want to achieve atonement,
right.
this is what you do. And you, what's the sort of, what's the thought behind the fact that the kohanim, the priests, get to eat your guilt, essentially? Why wouldn't that? It would, you would, if you were designing it yourself, perhaps, like, you would not think that that would be something that would not be burnt up completely.
Meaning that perhaps that would be something that's completely, you know, that's completely shared. It's an interesting thing. I don't know. I mean, I would offer, I'm not sure how to then make, you know, it's almost like whatever explanation you offer for those kinds of sacrifices, well, then how do you square away the reality that sometimes everything really does go up to Hashem? But it, you know, maybe.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that let's consider the following: that perhaps when it comes to something like a chatas, one of these, let's say, sin offerings. So the idea is, you know, that sometimes we fall into a place where, you know, we almost define religious activity or a failed religious experience as something that is really between myself and God. Right, that
or a successful non-religious, irreligious experience, is that
a successful irreligious experience? That's a terrible way of putting it.
Is that a PC term for sin?
I really succeeded in my irreligiosity today. I count that as a W. Maybe.
It's like the 76ers trying to get the draft pick,
tanking.
Yeah, I mean, wasn't that their strategy for a couple of seasons there?
I don't think that works in, yeah, right. Trust the process. Trust the process. I'm going to sin really extensively for the next couple of years, but boy, is that going to put me in good position to get, I don't think it works like that.
Well, there are no draft picks in your spiritual life, number one. And also, right. Just can we point out that I made a sports reference?
Yeah, no, that was great. That was great. that was amazing.
Unexpected. That hasn't happened on the podcast, and right. It rarely happens in my life.
That's amazing. Well, at least we got it recorded. So what I was going to suggest is that, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. That sometimes when we think of having failed at religion, we think of having failed at our relationship with God. But the reality is that, you know, just like there are two tablets, one of which contains those mitzvot that really flesh out the contours of our relationship with God, but the other, the mirror image, and the one that's equally important, speaks about our relationship with one another, or relationships with one another, right, between man and man. And perhaps that's part of the process here, part of the idea that in trying to gain penance for a chet that really was against God, I have to take note of the fact or take stock of the fact that it really bears incorporation of others also, that religion is not one-dimensional, can't just be a function of my relationship with God, but has to incorporate others as well. Of course, the difficulty is then, well, what does it mean to ever offer an ola that's completely consumed and goes up entirely on the mizbeach?
But that doesn't relate to sin, though.
Correct, right.
An ola is like, it's a voluntary thing you give because you are, like, I mean, you would think like sort of like intoxicated with God. You want to give something wholeheartedly. You're giving an entire animal. I mean, it's not a cheap thing.
I'm trying to zero in specifically on, you know, sometimes you have to, you know, it's like the difference maybe between, you know, going to like a general practitioner or going to a specialist. Sometimes you really do need to zero in on one particular area. And right now, you know, my ben adam l'chavero, my mitzvot between man and man are in a good place. And I'm trying to draw specifically closer into that relationship with God, you know, directly. And that's when maybe an ola comes up. Maybe it's, you know, there's something to be said for that, for the idea of trying to crawl back from a place of sin, not only by recognizing exclusively my relationship with God, but also my relationship with others.
Yeah, I think that I was thinking something along those lines. I wonder, I mean, I haven't seen that out there, but if any listeners have thoughts, please put it on the Facebook page. And then you mentioned the shlamim, which is another voluntary offering, which the owner gets to eat part of. It's like you are sharing a meal with God in as real a way as possible. And the name, of course, shlamim, comes from the sense of peace. You're sort of at peace with God, or wholeness.
Wholeness, right. Really both.
Peace and wholeness both have a root in Hebrew of Shin Lamed Mem, which refers to fullness. So are there any other main types that we're missing?
I mean, there are lots, and they get, you know, spun off in different directions. I mean, one of the items that we haven't really touched upon are the, you know, like a mincha.
That's what I was about to say.
which would be a meal offering.
And I'm sure you want to talk about that because you went to that place in Israel where they like...
Let me tell you, listeners. Let me tell you, if anybody finds themselves...
Didn't even get to finish my sentence. That's how excited Rabbi Biedenfeld is.
An incredible day that was. It is a workshop up in Karnei Shomron, and it is called Breads of the Beis Hamikdash, and it is just absolutely incredible. And speaks about all of these different meal offerings that would be offered in the actual temple service that we tend to gloss over. And the name of the person who runs it actually escapes me, but it's definitely online. And you can certainly find it. And if it comes back to me, I'll probably blurt it out at some point. But it's an absolutely incredible... It's a combination of like hands-on baking, parsha,
so let's biblical take a,
archaeology, so, medrash. Just absolutely incredible. Great for the whole family. So I get no royalties, but you got to go. You got to go.
We should get royalties. But to take a step back, so the mincha offering refers to offerings made of grain.
That's right.
I just wanted to clarify that. And what I think all of the sacrifices we mentioned include, like all the meat. There's meat and bread always together. We got to look at the details now. There's so many exception. These. We read the parsha and then all the different offerings start to blur together in my mind. But the point is that there are a number of these offerings that all have meal, and some are offered with the meat and some are offered separately, and we get all the different shapes and sizes, and some are fried and some are
prepared in different ways. Some are boiled or boiled and baked.
It's like a bagel. Except that none of these are actually leavened.
Right,
they're all. So when you say like a bagel, it's not like a bagel at all.
But even so, there are other tricks of the trade in terms of, well, you got to go to this workshop,
the biblical bread trade.
Yeah, ways of getting things to meaning. It doesn't mean that it was a matzah the way that we think of
flat,
a matzah, right?
Flat, crunchy. Why is it that it's not that it isn't leavened? I want to just say something about the word leaven, which is that one time my wife and I were driving in the car. It was a little bit before Pesach, and on public radio they were interviewing a rabbi about Passover, and I'm not going to say what rabbi it was, but I am going to say that when he said the word leaven, he sounded like Dr. Evil. He said, leaven, and... That is just so we. I can't say the word leaven without thinking of leaven.
Is it possible that it was Dr. Evil?
It is possible, but I don't think so.
Okay, I mean maybe we can.
Largely owing to Dr. Evil not being real, and also I think he was not a Jewish character.
Maybe you could fact check that just in case.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, thanks. That'd be great.
Anyway, leaven. It's just, but the word just kind of anyway. So why are they unleavened? Why is it? Why is there no bread inside of the tabernacle?
So we actually were just talking about this in one of the classes I gave this week, and there are lots of different explanations. But think of specifically around Pesach time, there are all of these ideas floating around about how chametz is basically evil, and about how chametz is the devil, and it's just and it's terrible, and we need to eradicate it, and we search our houses for chametz, and our office spaces and places of residence, and we get rid of it, and we eradicate it, we burn it, and then we spend this entire time making sure that we don't have even a trace of chametz or even a trace of chametz.
This is like proto keto.
Yes, it is exactly right. Exactly right. And then even after Pesach, we still avoid having any chametz that even was owned by a Jew on Pesach itself. So what are some of the classics? Some of the classics are that chametz is representative of arrogance, It's sort of a bloated sense of self that's not really based on anything true or real, because chametz is really that which has been given time to rise. Looks very big, looks very large. It's actually just full of air pockets.
Leaven is evil, would you say?
Are we going to keep going back to this? Is this going to happen?
You did a voice a couple weeks ago, and people loved it. And I'm not good at voices, but I can say Levin in the Dr. Evil voice.
Yeah, it was great. it was great. I enjoyed it.
All right, it's
the
over.
First time.
It's over.
Oh boy, maybe we could put some of these in the outtakes. The outtakes reel.
You're saying you don't think we should put this on the podcast?
I think we should put the first one on the podcast.
So you were saying?
No, it's all good. It's all good. The identity of chametz is always is always thoroughly questioned on and around Pesach. Now, of course, the reality is that even if chametz is inflated and bloated and it's not true and it's not truthful, it's not
ego.
It's ego. What else is chametz compared to the yetzer hara, right? That the evil inclination that gives us the sense that this is what you have to seek out. This is what's really important. This is what really matters. And then you get there and you realize that it's all just a load of hot air.
It's time.
Time, laziness, all of that, and therefore we try to eradicate it. So, of course, when it comes to Pesach, right, the sort of the elephant in the room is that we spend 51 weeks a year eating it, though. So it's not totally evil. And here too, right, we're saying that this is something that needs to be eradicated purely from the most intimate of spaces that we share with God or that we've prepared for God. We spoke about it a while ago that everything in the Mishkan, every movement and every action and the placement of every piece of furniture, every detail has been so perfectly set and formulated, and there can't really be any variation, because when you are just this close to God, we can't really allow for spontaneity, and you can't really allow for sort of freestyling. Everything needs to be really heavily scripted. And I think that's effectively what we're finding here, that all that which we speak about with respect to chametz as being improper and negative and detrimental. So ordinarily we can still indulge to some degree, but when it comes to being inside of God's home, then it's completely eradicated. It's not something that we allow, with a couple, maybe an exception.
What are some of the things you saw when you were at the Biblical Bread workshop place?
It's just wild, It was sort of getting a sense of the timing, right? Of just how quickly some of these things needed to be baked and how much skill needed to be involved. Like, this isn't really our parsha anymore, but Mr. Seidel, that was his name, but I don't remember his first name. Anyway, fascinating, fascinating fellow.
Hmm.
He, he actually had an example of the showbread that we baked together with him. And if you joined us for, back in the, Truma Tetzavin Vayakal Pekude episodes, and if perhaps you've ever seen the pictures, you'll know that effectively it looked sort of like a loaf of bread in the shape of an open box with actual... right angle turns but basically hollow inside, and just how difficult these things were to actually perform, how difficult they were to actually manufacture to make and to bake, and that he needed to have special kinds of molds made by welders who thought he was crazy when he made demanded all the specs on all these different things. So just amazing what a real art it was to produce these loaves of bread, the distinctions that existed between them, and to crank them out so thoroughly.
All right, so let's get to the other part of the parsha, which is kind of preparing the priests to serve in the tabernacle. So we've talked about the priests, the Kohanim, before, but I don't think we really talked about the underlying concept of why have priests in the first place?
Why have a priestly class?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think for me, it's very instructive that we do have a priestly class, because I think it helps. I think it helps the Jewish people appreciate their role in the world at large, meaning the relationship between the Jewish people and the rest of the world, the other nations of the world, is sort of captured in microcosm within the Jewish people itself, in the sense that there is, you know, I don't know that it's appropriate to call it a hierarchy, but that we have a sense that there is a leadership class, or that there is an educator class, that there are those who are going to be tasked with the all-important role of sort of serving as role models, showing everybody else how it's done. And it becomes much more of a responsibility than it is merely a privilege. It's both. It's both, but you really can't have one without the other. It's not a measure or matter of having been born with a particular pedigree, and I have a silver spoon in my mouth, and don't you know who my father was, my grandfather was, and therefore everybody has to worship me. It was really hard being a Kohen. Well, I mean, really hard, at least when you were on.
Which was only 2 weeks a year.
Right.
In the temple times. I don't know what's going on in the...
Presumably.
Far more frequently. In the tabernacle, we're talking about three people.
Exactly. I mean, very, very, very taxing.
Though, okay, so, I mean, you know, we don't always try to imagine what it was like, but the truth of the matter is that, I mean, the Jewish people are getting manna from the sky for their meals. They're probably not bringing... you know, we know that they have some they have some livestock. Some people have more than others, but like
sure, they definitely had meat, and the livestock was presumably reproducing to some degree.
Yeah,
as livestock are
it does do that
to do.
Okay, so I guess they're doing.
I mean, we'll get to this when we get to Sefer Devarim. I think it's in Parshas Re'eh. I don't remember exactly Re'eh or Akev. That there's actually an important distinction that exists between meat eating in the wilderness and meat eating in the land of Israel, in that if you wanted to personally eat an animal in the wilderness, it needed to be brought first to the Beit HaMikdash as a korban. And it wasn't
the Mishkan, you mean?
To the Mishkan. As opposed to once they arrive in the land of Israel, then meat can be slaughtered and can be enjoyed at least on a personal level. Even without it being, you know, sanctified, and without any portion of it being offered in the Mishkan,
so you couldn't opt in. You can't. There's no way to become a priest.
Not that I'm aware of, money talks.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, historically speaking, it wasn't
a big problem.
It was an institution that became ultimately corrupted, and we talked a little bit last week about how the institution of sacrifices, you know, in the times of the prophets becomes, the prophets kind of say that God doesn't really want the sacrifices. God wants you to be good people, to feed the poor, and to commit yourselves to justice and to building a just society. And similarly, during the Second Temple period, it becomes like, you know, there's sources that talk about it being sold to the highest bidder, the office of the high priest.
Right, and it was just a terrible landscape. I mean, it really, really was in the time of the Second Temple. You can appreciate where some of the early Christian ideas, you know, before it even became its own religion, but when it was just this splinter sect within Judaism that pushed back against mainstream fundamentalist Judaism, you could sort of appreciate why there were, you know, why that gained traction, because there was a lot of pushback against what was going on in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, that you had a lot of bribery.
Yeah, the moneylenders in the temple.
So, yeah, the moneylenders in the temple is sort of an interesting thing in of itself, meaning it almost seems that was considered to be, you know, sacrilegious in of itself, and from a Jewish perspective, we would never... It
doesn't actually seem that way.
It doesn't actually seem that way, meaning that we've always...
You needed certain currency in order to do business
in
the temple.
We always know that the reality of the temple is going to be this place where sort of heaven meets earth, and sort of some of the realities of what take place, and meaning, yeah, marketplaces and money exchanging and buying and selling of animals, and, you know, people going out to, you know, shops and restaurants and buying little tchotchkes for family that they're going to bring home as a souvenir from Jerusalem. All those things were bound to take place, and certainly were taking place within the general environs of the Temple Mount. But there was also a lot of, you know, a lot of uh, just just scandalous kind of bribery and sales to the highest bidder for positions of authority. It's a big problem. I guess where ultimately Judaism parted ways was the fidelity to the system, even as there is a recognition that the system needs to be corrected. But meaning not saying that the system should be jettisoned because look at the possibility of power being corrupted or of these offices being corrupted, but that it needs to change. It needs to be better, and we're going to hold out for making it better.
There are facets within our own community that want to deny that people in leadership positions can do anything wrong. But I think the conversation we're having is one which I think is authentic, which says, yeah, we have a monarchy, but the monarchy has to be kept in check. And yeah, there's a priestly class, but that can be corrupted. And there can be, you know, we're going to talk about false prophets later on. And there's all, you know, just leadership and different classes of leadership. Nothing is infallible, and nothing just because something falls apart or can fall apart doesn't mean that it isn't that it doesn't have potential to be great, doesn't mean that it doesn't have a purpose to serve. And that's, I just think it's such an important idea to hold on to, because people, you know, and in so many different ways in the world today, people, you know, will either rush to the defense of an idea, even when it's patently obvious, or it should be patently obvious, that the person or the institution representing that idea is in need of some kind of correction, or you know, total disillusionment and undermining of institutions also. So, you know, maintaining that kind of middle road between saying, you know, there's a value to institutions, or there's an ideal, and it's, just because it's not always met doesn't mean it has no value. I think it's harder than it sounds.
It's very hard. I think it's very hard because maybe this is a rosy view of things, but I think that, you know, the human being is sort of an idealist by nature. I meaning that even cynicism, I think, comes from a desire for idealism. And almost once we see that any given human being or any given role or any given institution can't live up to the state of idealism that we'd otherwise imagine or hope for, we sometimes tend to become extremely cynical.
I completely agree.
Because I think it's sort of one or the other, meaning I will turn a blind eye and insist that, no, this really is still as ideal as we would have imagined. And there will be cover-ups, and there will be an insistence that it's absolutely perfect and it's unbroken in any way. And you'll have that camp. And then you'll have the other camp that says that this has been a debacle and a failure, and it just has to be jettisoned. And trying to live in that space in between is really where, frankly, we belong. Where on the one hand we are, I don't even know if I want to use the word suspicious, but we're cautious,
I think it's mature. I think it's a matter of being. I think it's adulthood.
Yeah.
Like, I think being a grown up is recognizing that the world is not perfect, but it, you know, not being completely naive to the need and the value of institutions. And listen, I mean,
it's a balance.
We're speaking abstractly. This can be applied in so many different ways and places. And I think that's somewhat intentional because it applies so broadly. And also, I don't think we want to necessarily go into any specifics and start to have,
but it's true of arguments. Look, it's true of religious institutions and religious people, and it's true and religious leaders, and it's true of political institutions and political ideas and political leaders. You know, just because the king or the president or the rabbi has been made a total fool of himself and has besmirched that office, that doesn't mean that the office as an institution is poor. It doesn't mean that everybody else is now guilty until proven innocent, on the one hand. On the other hand, it would be never raising an eyebrow and never concerning ourselves with the realities that these are positions that can become corrupt would put us in a state of naivete that's really ripe for almost culthood.
Yeah. So to wrap it up, in order to prepare to assume the role in the tabernacle. So Moshe prepares Aharon, his brother, becomes the high priest, and his children. He kind of teaches them. He anoints them, and then two things I want to point out. And one is just that so they give these sacrifices, and they one of them is the chatat, to sort of a mass atonement for any things that they've done. But then he also he sprinkles blood on them, which I think is kind of gross. It says in Perek Chet, that would be chapter 8, verse 30, Moses took from the oil of anointment and some of the blood that was on the Mizbeach, that is the altar, and he sprinkled it upon Aaron and his vestments and upon his sons and upon the vestments of his sons who were with him. Thus he sanctified Aaron and his vestments and his sons and the vestments of his sons with him. I don't know what to make of that. I just think it's kind of gross. So I don't know. Like, it's one of those things that, like, just, you know, you don't notice, or they don't tell you about growing up, and then you read that and you're like, that, wow, okay. All right. I mean, listen, you know,
Kohanim, we're going to be seeing a lot more blood from here on out.
So. It's get used to being sprinkled with blood. It's exactly. a little bit of hazing. It's the word I was going to use. The other thing, which is a little bit more serious, is that it's a 7-day ceremony, and I think that's so interesting in terms of we spoke before about the tabernacle as a parallel for the creation of the world, and the idea that the people serving in it have 7 days of kind of practice, going through the motions. Moshe tells them, at the entrance of the tent of meeting shall you dwell day and night for a 7-day period. So I just thought that was another piece of the comparison that we've been drawing.
There's one other element here that I just think is so interesting, which is that part of the process of preparing the Kohanim is, one, a purification. We know the purification generally comes through some sort of ritual immersion or washing with water, cleansing through water. That's one. And the other is actually, as we read about in a couple of Parshiot and Parshat Tetzaveh, and then again Parshat Pekudei, that there are these actual garments, there are these vestments. And what's fascinating to me, and I just think this image is striking, so striking that I just think it's got to be true, that that Moshe is the one who's really initiating all of this. Meaning, it's not just that these are the clothing that you have to wear, and it's not just that you have to purify yourselves in order to rise to the level of Kohen and serve in that office, but the way that it's described is that Moshe actually washes them, or actually rinses them, in this water of purification, and he's the one who actually dresses them. And to me, you think about sort of washing someone else and clothing someone else, and there's something about that just strikes me as being so paternal, right? The idea of almost like these are the two things that parents do for their children. They, you know, they bathe them and they clothe them. And this, you know, I'm reminded of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch has this beautiful line about education. He says that the teacher is the person whose role it is to become superfluous. And you know that you've done the job as either the teacher or as the parent when the baton has been so thoroughly passed that now you have others who actually don't really need you anymore and can sort of stand on their own. And this is the first scenario in which there is in terms of judgment and things like that, but in real public ritual life, this is the first opportunity or the first scenario in which Moshe is going to retreat in order to allow space for others to actually exist and for others to sort of do their job and do their role. And there's something that just strikes me as being very, very parental about that. The idea that I'm basically raising my own children to try to function on their own and be out in the world. And in this case, be in the Mishkan and be able to serve Hashem and be able to serve in a real significant position of leadership. Moshe is saying that, you know, it's sort of like enough of being all about me, and I'm going to provide this space and bring those around me and bring my other family members into this space to be able to serve in that capacity.
I think that is a beautiful idea to close the show with. The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzvat. We are sponsored by the Pravda Family Foundation. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review, and you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn. Have a happy Purim, and shout out to Simply Tzvat, who were in Cherry Hill last week, and I was very happy to see them and thank them for letting us use their music. And if you don't know, if the only thing you know about Simply Tzvat is that they do our intro and outro music, you should definitely download. I can't say buy their records. Maybe, but buy their records or download them or stream them or whatever.
Buy their vinyl album now, wherever fine records are sold.
Get the 8-track, whatever it is you do. Check it out and thank you to Simply Tzvat. It was great seeing you guys. All right, bye.